Our next two presenters are from the state of New York. Both of them dear good friends of mine. They did a very comprehensive study and way of developing the material they're going to talk about with you today, which is really a comprehensive study and method on a sustainability model for CHWs in the state of New York. So Sergio Montos is the Executive Director of the Community Health Worker Network of New York City, and Sally Finley is a professor at Columbia University. So I'll welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've got a little bit of a dog and a pony show going here. So I'm going to start off, and then at a certain point, which will become obvious, Sergio will take over. And thank you to the organizers. I mean, the CHW section today so far has been fabulous. So we're all very glad you're here. That's our disclosure. We wish we had some more money, but we don't. I think the fact that you're all here, and I recognize some of you from the session that I was just at, the Triple Aim session, that a lot of you don't really need to have this slide about why do we need CHWs, but I just want to remind you that from the point of view of developing a statewide process, it's very important to have documentation about these things. So to remind you again, CHWs bridge. They bridge. We bridge between the community and the health system. We do this in an effective way. There is an evidence base that demonstrates this, that CHWs make a difference, and not just a small difference, a significant difference. Many different studies using many different study designs have documented that. That CHWs address disparities. I think those of you who were at the previous session, the Triple Aim session, were very moved by not only the presentations that our sisters gave, but the presentation that was done also via long distance from Eduardo, that CHWs bring up and help everybody get involved in ways that they couldn't do before and maybe wouldn't have done. The Triple Aim Care, we just were talking about that, and that CHWs are actually written into the legislation in different places in the Affordable Care Act. These were all very important things that were behind the initiative that we're describing. So in New York, what we decided was that we wanted to establish a process within New York for having a scope of practice that would be an agreed-upon set of activities, roles, and tasks that people within the state could recognize that these are the things that are within the purview of community health workers. That there are training. At this point, when we started this, we could see that there were many different venues. There were many different kinds of content. What defines the most, a community health worker, who gets to train, where they get trained. There were many different questions that we had. And credentials, that was a biggie that was floating out there. You know, do we standardize it? What happens to the grandmothering in of CHWs who have been wonderful and brilliant but may not have ever gotten any kind of an academic credit? Where does everybody fit in? And funding, as you all know, funding is a big issue. So all of these things were propelling us in New York to think about this. So we launched a community health worker initiative, and Sergio and I were the co-leaders of that initiative. We were lucky to have funding from the New York State Health Foundation, and we were able to have a wonderful young woman, April Hicks, join us, and she's not able to be here today, but she's very much in spirit with us on this initiative. So we started out by building a leadership advisory group with all the thought leaders in their different domains, whether it was in the community health centers, whether it was from the hospitals, whether it was from the community organizations, and we made a very, very important presence from the very start of community health workers, that community health workers from all over the state be involved in this leadership advisory group. We formed work groups. We had a work group for scope of practice, for training and credentialing, and for funding. And each work group was co-led by a CHW and one of these thought leaders. And each work group had a series of meetings and phone calls over a process of about 6 months? Or a little longer, actually. And for the background of this, we actually had done surveys of both community health workers and employers of community health workers to the tune of around 250 community health workers and 80 employers to find out what they thought about these topics. And so we sort of had that evidence base from within the state that would help inform these decisions. So then we wanted to develop essentially workforce standards, and we took a labor force perspective. Okay, if this is the job, what would the job description look like? How, if you had to standardize it, what would be the critical elements? And then the training, what would go into that? So each work group established a set of recommendations, and then we, at the end of, really it was a long year, probably a year and a half, we brought together everybody in a statewide conference to go over the recommendations and think about it. And we had, I don't know, how was around 300 people at the meeting, and it was an amazing process to have everybody in the room, both the thought leaders and the community health workers, to see the product of these long conversations. So I'm describing it long because that's by way of describing our method. So the scope of practice, we actually used a lot of the data from the survey that we had conducted over a period of time to develop that evidence base for. We had a series of questions about what do you do, what have you been trained at, what training would you like. If you were an employer, what training do you provide? What training would you like to have had provided? How do you get funding? And so it was a very detailed set of questions. And we did the analysis of it in several waves. And we added some more questions in between one wave, so when we realized we didn't have data about everything. And we went back to the community health worker network from time to time to say, this doesn't make sense, what do you think? So we used a participant ranking methodology essentially to help people understand why is there this difference between what the employers say and what the community health workers say? And I think that for those of you who have done community-based participatory research, this interactive process that engages everybody in that research process to really think through what is the significance of this and where are we going with this, that really strengthened what we were doing, because what we were able to do really came out more as a consensus because of that interaction and because of being able to digest and put it together than if we had just simply done the data analysis and said, okay, over here we're all in agreement, and over here we're not in agreement, we're just going to set it aside. So that participatory ranking methodology really helped us to bring everything together. Then we still had a little more data analysis that we did using both state and Excel. And probably the last thing the scope of practice working group did was, after we had decided on the basic roles that were coming out of there, we did a really detailed functional task analysis. If I were doing this, which specific tasks would I need to do? Like filling out forms or entering it into the computer, or I have to do a home visit for this, or I have to be able to talk with the pharmacist about it. So we had a really detailed list, and then we backed it up and we said, okay, what kind of training would you need? So the functional task analysis for the scope of practice, which it took us forever. It seemed like we were for all, forever working on it, really was the backbone to making sure that the scope of practice recommendations, which I'm going to show you in a moment, were what was needed by the other working groups so that they would know that their recommendations for training and for credentialing really covered the kinds of detail that would be necessary for a community health worker to be functional doing these things in the state of New York. So this is the overview, and for those of you who've been around and are familiar with the different studies, the different kinds of roles and that community health workers are often described as performing, you'll recognize a lot of them. We tweaked a couple of them. Home visiting also comes up sometimes as just plain home visiting, but we realize it's not just the visit, it's the support, and that is home-based. So we changed the terminology there to home-based support. And also based on many conversations within the community health worker network and on our phone calls, we took health promotion and turned it into health promotion and coaching. Because the coaching really gets at more of that interactive, use your experience, use the role modeling aspect that I think is such an important part of, I don't know how many of you were able to hear Felicia Lane's very moving stories in the session beforehand, but she basically helped us see right then and there how she coaches in being able to weave between her story and the stories of the people in the community and the stories of the people that she's working with. So we changed that to health coaching. And in New York, we added something that often doesn't show up, which is participatory research, because it turned out that a lot of the community health workers were working within a university or a university academic community partnership context where it was very important for them to be able to have some research skills. And where are the research skills the community health workers are often called on? It's bringing in the community, listening to the community. So we isolated that as a separate skill. You can't read the detail, but it's there. And we have an article that came out in AJPH, I think it was October, that summarizes the development of this scope of practice. So don't feel like you have to get all the details down. It's a slightly different presentation there, but you'll get the essence. The other thing that the Scope of Practice Working Group was very clear about is that being a community health worker is not something that everybody can do. You can't just walk in the door and say, oh, community health worker job, I think I'll try that. I've been a secretary, I guess I'll be a community health worker now. You don't temp as a community health worker. You are a community health worker. And I think, again, the stories that we heard from Maria and from Felicia this morning were just so poignant in helping us identify what some of those attributes are, that you feel connected, that you're resourceful, that you're always thinking on your feet. I remember in some of the feedback, some of the conversations I've had, people, you know, community health workers, they walk down the street, their pockets are full. And they always have the right piece of paper to give to somebody when they're talking to them. Being mature, being persistent, empathetic. Don't you think that Felicia Lane story this morning, wow, that's empathy. So open-minded, respectful, friendly. That's a very important thing. It's often overlooked. Not everybody can be a community health worker because you do have to go up and talk to people. And dependable. So we put these together as both the kinds of things you might put into a job description, those tasks you're going to have to do, da-da-da-da-da-da, and it's not every community health worker that is going to have to do all those things. Each program, each situation might choose to emphasize certain elements of this, but when you're thinking about what kind of training you need, ultimately, this in New York is what we decided we would want for core competencies for community health workers, but that if you were to recruit somebody and you had to say, well, we're looking for these attributes in persons, these would be the attributes you look for in that interview context. So that was what the Scope of Practice Working Group came up with in terms of a mix of skills and attributes. And now I'm going to turn it over to Sergio, who's going to continue to take it from there in terms of how the training work and credentialing work group proceeded.
Thank you, Sally. So just to go back here for a minute, employers told us that this is the stuff they look for. When they're looking for a CHW, this is what they look for. They're not looking for an associate degree. They're not looking for an MD degree. They're not looking for, they're looking for qualities. They say, employers tell us, and CHWs themselves tell us repeatedly, we can give people training. We can buy them training. We can give them, we can provide training. We can't give you this. This is your soul. This is your spirit. This you got to come with. And if you don't come with that, then you're probably not going to succeed as a CHW. So when you hear discussions about promoting us to become mini nurses or promoting us to become something else, you got to remember that there are some essential core qualities that lead to success in one being a CHW. And discussions around promoting us and advancing us should really be within our own practice. So, you know, we can become senior CHWs. We can become managing CHWs. We can become CHW executive directors. We can become CHW CEOs. And then there are CHWs who may want to go on to become a nurse. The other thing I want to reiterate is that all these work groups that we formed were co-led by a CHW and one other leader in our in our leadership advisory group. And people told us, oh, CHWs can't be with these CEOs and these MD administrators. And I'm here to tell you that, yes, we can. And yes, we did. As a matter of fact, Ray Lopez is sitting here with us, and he chaired one of the work groups, in particular the work group around financing. And, you know, again, we were told, oh, that's not CHW's expertise. Well, it is our discipline, and it is our practice. And, yes, we are able to do that. The training, the other thing that we did is we didn't want to come up with a standard training curriculum, one holy curriculum that everybody had to buy and enforce, because we wanted to leverage existing resources. And so what we really sought to do was to establish training standards. And then anybody who might be interested in meeting those standards could then, you know, could leverage those resources. Here's the standards that we came up with. And we came up with standards both in terms of content and in terms of pedagogy, methodology, this is going to be interesting. Sometimes people love this, sometimes people hate it. But we were very specific that the CHW's training should be responsive to our scope of practice. We have a scope of practice, which you just saw. So training should be responsive to that. So, you know, it's not just there were many community colleges in our neighborhood who were throwing loose courses together and calling it a CHW certificate program. That's not legitimate. If you want to develop training programs for us, then these are our standards that we expect. In particular, we wanted training programs to have a focus around justice and the social determinants of health. There was a very brave presentation this morning where two women were very clear that, you know, why talk about obesity, why talk about diabetes when those aren't the root causes? There are root causes and there are social injustices. And poverty is at the top of those. So if you're going to talk about diabetes and asthma and obesity, then you need to talk about poverty, because that is the primary determinant of our health. And we also, so in terms of content, we had a specific content. In terms of pedagogy, these are very good friends of ours, Bill Bauer and David Werner. They wrote a book called Helping Health Workers Learn and Teach. Listen, this is not a secret. Some of you are very accomplished learners and high-end learners, and you learn very well from PowerPoints and lectures. That's unusual in the universe. You know, it took you a good 16 to 20 years to learn how to learn that way. And most people who are not, you know, privy to a formal education really don't learn very well that way. So lecture really does not work. And so in our standards, we ask that that pedagogies which involve interactive, participatory, experiential learning, adult learning. There is a discipline called adult learning. Like you can actually, like, you know, you can go to a college and get a PhD in adult learning, although we largely ignore that whole discipline. There are adult learning principles, and they work. They're real. It's a science. It's a discipline. So we encourage that. We were told in our working groups that we could not enforce any particular philosophy when we were establishing guidelines, but we insisted that any training for CHWs be deeply rooted in popular education philosophies, which hold that learners are wise and knowledgeable and not dependent on a single expert to lecture to them for their whole lives, and further holds that all education really should lead to justice and social change. It's based on Freirean philosophies, which talk about praxis, and that all education should lead to social change. These are some of the comments that we've received from curricula that use these standards. People routinely refer to these experiences as transformative, as life-changing. And these are some of the comments about the methodology itself, the pedagogy. So this stuff is all available on our website at chwnetwork.org, and I'll let Sally finish with the discussion about financing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that one can finish the conversation. So the credentialing issue is actually a serious one, because is it a training issue? Is it a funding issue? And it's interesting that we split our presentation on funding and training right over here on the credentialing. So there were a whole set of recommendations that on pertaining to credentialing, and the credentialing ended up being something we realized we had to deal with, because it's linked to how do you connect the money to the people and who gets it. So these were the sets of recommendations that CHWs and consumers should be involved. We didn't want to say these are the standards, but we could say that whatever credentialing process is established needs to have the voice of CHWs and the employers, the consumers of CHWs, the participants, the community involved in establishing what that credential should be. And that the credential should be based on that scope of practice, which I just talked about. That it should be linked to the training. So the workforce, even though we had these different work groups that were separate, in a sense, the credentialing recommendations were the knot that is woven together to bring together the scope of practice and the training and the funding in a way that doesn't hand it off to say, okay, now there's going to be this external body and they're going to follow all this and thank you, we're done. Because we know from experience that you can't just hand this off. It has to continue to be participatory the whole way. So that the statewide CHW credential should also not just be, okay, this is for asthma, this is for diabetes, this is for TB drug adherence, this is for maternal care, et cetera, et cetera. It needs to include both the core skills, the communication skills, the informal, the coaching skills, not just topic specific. And that we didn't want the credential to be the hurdle that no one could jump over. You know, you have a big race and then suddenly there's a hurdle and nobody can jump it. So we wanted to make sure the credential process recognized the need for people to be able to get over that hurdle and get there, so that cost, testing, recertification, immigration status would not be the door closers, but rather door openers. And that experienced CHWs wouldn't have to sort of start all over as if they never had done the work before. So the financing recommendations were split up between public and private. So for private, we had recommendations for commercial insurance, that for health insurance plans, and that there are various different ways that health insurance plans pay for care and services. And the bottom line here is wherever it's possible to put in a CHW for reimbursement, put them in. And for the philanthropies, to recognize that philanthropies do have a role in maybe helping us do demonstrations and helping us pilot different models, and that the philanthropies can, in fact, work in partnership to fund, figure out which of these funding strategies work the best. Recommendations for Medicaid and Medicare. New York has a Medicaid redesign team which has been working and was working throughout this entire period. And so we were trying to come up with recommendations that could feed into this Medicaid redesign team. And I think that though we didn't make the first cut, as it turns out, I think that we kept CHWs in the conversation, that CHWs are recognized as health professionals, that they would be integrated into the PCMH, the health homes, the accountable care organizations, that the standards of funding would, again, refer back to that scope of practice. I think a lot of you are familiar with the PCMH incentives to finance CHW services, and so we had a set of recommendations about how they might be tweaked and what could be brought in and what wouldn't. And then, of course, to evaluate, because if people aren't aware of the benefit, the financial returns of CHWs, then it's hard to go back and say, well, don't forget, you have to have CHWs funded. So then there were some more for state programs, because states, in New York State has a community health worker program. New York State has a couple of programs that do fund community health workers, so we wanted to make sure we included something there also. And I think one of the things that we wanted to call attention to is that organizations essentially make money when they use CHWs, because they're not using more expensive health care. So part of our recommendations that goes to the sustainability question is reinvestment. I think that's our last one. So thank you, and I know I probably went over. I can't see Anne. She was probably going... and so thank you for being patient with us for our long presentation.